This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Julianne Malvo says you can call her a feminist, an iconoclast, or an angry black woman. She's an economist by training. She gave up academia for a more public forum. She's a regular contributor to USA Today and Ms. Magazine. She's also a regular panelist on the public TV program To the Contrary, featuring liberal and conservative women debating women's issues. Malvo has a new collection of her columns called Sex, Lies, and Stereotypes. She likes to point out the connections between racial and economic injustice. For instance, last month's statistics showed whites have a 5.5% unemployment rate, but unemployment among African Americans is double that.
It's not just about people living in ghettos, because even when you look at people within certain occupations, you find unemployment rate differentials. We can go on to talk about issues of wealth, all the studies that the Federal Reserve Board has done about access to things like mortgage and business lending. The Federal Reserve Board is publishing studies that say that a wealthy black is twice as likely to be turned down for a loan as a poor white.
Now, you think that African Americans should spend more money in the black community on black-owned businesses. Why do you think that's important?
It's clear that African American people have $300 to $350 billion in disposable income. All the money is not available for supporting businesses. Some of it obviously goes for food and rent and et cetera. But if we can build a strong entrepreneurial infrastructure in our community, that means more jobs. It also is a question of self-help and pride. It's a question of people being able to see businesses we own, we support, we operate. The entrepreneurial spirit in the African American community is not absent. There's a strong history of black entrepreneurial development and work. But there's also a strong history in this country of discouraging black entrepreneurship with laws. They begin with the Jim Crow laws that prevented black men from owning the tools of their trade. So black entrepreneurship has been discouraged, but the spirit is there, and I think that we need to nurture it.
Has there been a lot of growth in black-owned businesses recently?
In the past, from 1982 to 1987, which is where we have the most recent data, we saw a 7% growth. If that growth rate increases 7% annually through the year 2000, there could be as many as a million black-owned businesses by then. In 1987, there were about 470,000. But those million black businesses could or could not make a difference. It depends on whether or not they have employees. Most black businesses now do not have more than 5 employees. Most are very small. So part of the whole notion of black business growth and development is the notion of growing larger businesses that generate employment.
You're the vice president of the National Association of Negro Business. What are some of the other big issues in black-owned small businesses now?
In addition to access to credit and access to development, the whole issue of minority business set-asides remains important. There have been many difficulties with cities having set-aside programs, so we continue to advocate for that. As well, there are issues about franchising and fairness. A number of the franchises have been criticized and scrutinized because of their attempt to redline African-American entrepreneurs into inner cities without providing them with opportunities to have franchises elsewhere.
In your collection of columns, Sex, Lies, and Stereotypes, one of the things you write about is your recommendation for a red and sweet boycott. explain what that would be.
Well, African-American people disproportionately consume things that are red and sweet. Barbecue sauce, ketchup, red soda water, just all the data show that we disproportionately consume certain things. And all too often, corporate America ignores the existence of the black consumer market. People don't pay attention to this market. And I think if, for example, African-American people decide to boycott ketchup, that the head of Heinz would be calling Ben Chavis within 5 minutes. Please, Ben, would you get these black folks to buy just a little more ketchup?
So what would you ask for in return? What would you want to call off the boycott?
Jobs, opportunities, business franchises, any number of things. A conversation that's honest and that calls us all to the table as equals, not one of these condescending conversations that says, oh, gee, look at what we've done to black people. You know, look at the most recent thing that happened with Denny's. Now, Denny's had a record of discriminating. But when their CEO announced their $60 million settlement, which he said was 46, but when you add on everything else, it was 60. He also said, but we never discriminated. I mean, get a life, boyfriend. You discriminated. And you want to have a conversation that says, look, let's move ahead, but let's acknowledge. People don't want to acknowledge.
Do you think that there have been any African-American boycotts of companies that have been very successful in the past?
I think the push Excel model that Reverend Jackson had in the 1970s had many successes. There have been many boycotts that have not been successful, but have raised issues. Certainly, the Nike boycott raised a lot of questions. It was not as big a success as it might have been, but I think it did alert Nike to the African-American market and did move them to establish some franchises in the African-American community. But part of the problem is, of course, white racism. Part of the problem is black complacence. A lot of people are too happy to go along, to get along. They don't want to boycott because they don't want people to think that they care about race.
My guest is Julianne Melvo, an economist and columnist with a new book called Sex, Lies, and Stereotypes. We're after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Julianne Melvo. You write about the differences in the agenda of some African-American and some white women. You say black and white women can't be true and honest allies unless white women understand that the economic status of black men is part of the black feminist agenda. Can I ask you to elaborate on that?
Sure. Lots of, in the feminist struggle, there's been a lot of male bashing, and the male bashing has been about men's power. African-American men don't have that same kind of power, and we can't really see them in the black community as the enemy. We're looking at racism and sexism and how they are intertwined, and part of the intertwining is something that I call the third burden of black women. If African-American men face discrimination in a patriarchal structure, this forces another burden on black women. If my man cannot find a job, that means I have to work more hours. That means my double day becomes a triple day. If my child constantly collides with a criminal justice system because young black men standing on corners are immediately suspect, that again takes my double day as worker and mother and turns it into a triple day because now I'm spending time arguing with police officers about what my child did or did not do. I think that by and large, white women have been fairly myopic about some of those issues. I think that's changed a lot, Terry, in the last 5 or 6 years. But I think white women don't think about the privilege of whiteness enough. And when they talk about us all being women, fail to understand that their womanhood is placed on a pedestal while mine is placed on the floor.
You wrote a column a couple of years ago, June of 92, called No Means No, about, and the column was inspired when you were approached by a young man who was selling the Nation of Islam newspaper, The Final Call, and you told him no thanks, and he kept trying to sell it to you. Tell us what your reaction was to this and why your reaction was so strong.
I think that in many ways, black women are at the bottom of the food chain. Anybody feels free to abuse us, and nobody comes to our aid. This was an interaction that was a racial interaction, a black man attempting to first cajole and then browbeat and then harass a black woman into buying his paper.
What was he saying to you to get you to buy the paper?
Well, he started to buy a paper, sister. I said, no, thank you. I mean, quite frankly, I actually even have that issue of the paper at home. So how many, you know, final calls do I need? But then he's, you know, he went on to talk about his quota and he needed to meet his quota, yada, yada. And then it went from there to, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. You buy something from a white person, you know, all you women are brainwashed. I think he called me a heathen or a hussy or something because my skirt was too short. And I was like, excuse me. We're in an elevator. It was an enclosed space. No, I really wasn't afraid because, you know, I can defend myself, but I felt that it was intimidating to have two men with these papers in my face harass me. And it just reminded me how weak institutionally my voice often is, not my personal voice, but my black women's voice. My concerns are often peripheralized. We're asked, you know, give me a break. We'll get to your concerns eventually. And it's just institutionally infuriating. And I always play this game of what if, you know, what if it was a white woman? Well, they would not have dared have such a conversation with a white woman. What if it was a white man? They wouldn't have approached him. A black man would have said, look, no thanks. That would have been the end of it. I was the only person that they could have run that ridiculous rap on and gotten away with it.
There's been a movement in schools to have classes that are specifically for young black men taught by black male teachers. And part of the argument for that is that black men are becoming an endangered species, and that young black males are in such danger, they require special treatment to keep them safe, to keep them from falling into the wrong crowd or the wrong hands or the wrong way of life. And this has been taken before the courts recently, the whole question of male-only classes. But I wonder about your thinking behind that.
I think this notion that black men can only be taught by black men is ludicrous. If such were the case, you wouldn't have had a Martin Luther King or Ben Chavis or any of the other civil rights leaders. African-American women have primarily been the teachers. It suggests that women cannot transmit education. I mean, there's a sexist component to this that's incredibly ugly. And what kind of signal does that send to young black girls? That boys cannot learn with them? I think there may well be a place for single-sex education. I'm not sure that it should happen in the public school system. And I'm also disturbed about the theory that has been used to advance this notion of black male-only academies. Furthermore, this concept of the black man as an endangered species is racist, it's wrong, and it's a throwback to 19th century eugenism. I mean, endangered species as in a different species than the rest of us? I mean, when I think of endangered species, I think of like bald-headed eagles and red-spotted owls. I don't think of the people that I sleep with or play with or hang out with. I don't think of the people that I, you know, have dinner with. I mean, give me a break. Endangered species really does speak in many ways to a notion that these folks are so different, so distinctly different, that they cannot be helped.
You know, a lot of people say that when you grow up poor, no matter how much money you make, you always feel like you can become poor again the next day. But when you grow up middle class, even if you don't have money for a while, you feel like, well, you'll probably always be middle class. What do you think of that? Does that apply to you at all?
Probably to some extent. I mean, I've probably never thought of myself as a poor person, even though I think when you look at black middle class incomes in the early 60s, these folks were poor by numerical standards. But yeah, I think that you have a sense of security. You have an education. You're thoughtful. You know that if plan A doesn't work, there's always a plan B. And if you have to keep thinking, you can get to plan Z. But one of the plans will work. It is a sense of also, I think, the Unity talks about the white hyacinths we have for our soul, that you don't just save and you don't just scrimp, but you also enjoy yourself, enjoy life. Understand that the part of life is what Langston Hughes called the sweet flypaper of life, the little stuff. And so I really, in my work, which is very type A, I also try to make sure that I remember the sweet flypaper.
Well, Julianne Malvo, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Julianne Malvo has a new collection of columns called Sex, Lies, and Stereotypes. This is Fresh Air.